Sean Bonner, according to his website, no one knows what he does. But what we know is it has to do with nuclear power. So Sean, take it away.
Hi. Hello. 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 Can you hear me? Okay. Hey, so I'm going to talk about this project called Safecast that I've been working on for the past 2 years or so. I'm going to start off with a couple stories that will sort of put it in a little bit of context for you. So in April 2011, a group of people that we were sort of working together with on this project went to Fukushima with a bag full of Geiger counters. They were the first Geiger counters we'd gotten our hands on at this point. And they went there with the plans of measuring the contamination levels at schools. At this point, there wasn't really any information getting out to the public. Nobody knew what was going on. People couldn't get anything reliable. They didn't know who to trust with the information that was getting out. And so we sort of had taken it upon ourselves to try to get some of this data. And we weren't really sure how long we were going to be able to do this. It was sort of a weird political climate. We sort of assumed that there would be someone who knew what they were doing that was going to come in at some point and do stuff. So we figured that if nothing else, if we can get in and measure a couple schools, that would probably be good. And we didn't think that we'd get a lot of political blowback from that, because who would object to measuring schools and making sure the kids were safe? And it turned out that the schools objected. And we were actually told that we couldn't take measurements at the schools because what happens if we find something? Then they would have to do something about it. That actually happened. So a couple months after that, once we had gotten into the habit of going and taking these measurements and everything, we found this area, which is actually, at this point, the highest radiation levels that we had found. And so this border is actually at the evacuation zone that had been set up by this point. So across that line, it's considered unsafe to live by the Japanese government at this point. Everybody got kicked out. And so on this side of it, there was a handful of guards who were standing around making sure that people didn't cross that because it's not safe. So they were standing around all day, every day, for over a month at this point, and the only thing they had was some rubber gloves and paper masks. And so we were there in a car, and we had a bunch of Geiger counters, and they're all going ballistic and beeping all over the place. And we're talking to these guys, and we're like, so it's unsafe right there, but you're right here, like, all day long. Are you worried? And these guys were like, no, our bosses say it's safe, so we have to trust that. So that's sort of like what was going on at this point. All right, so I'll go back and explain like where that all leads to. So March 11th, 2011, there's this earthquake and resulting triple meltdown at Fukushima Daiichi in Fukushima in Japan. And I was in Los Angeles, and we have earthquakes in Japan, or we have earthquakes in Los Angeles, so, you know, sort of out of mutual earthquake respect, I'm emailing my friends in Japan right away, making sure everybody's okay. Some of them had information, some people didn't know what was going on. So really quickly, a handful of us were on an email chain and realized that people in Japan couldn't get any information, probably because they were freaking out because there was, like, you know, a nuclear plant melting down not too far from them. So we thought, look, we know how to internet. We are going to go collect this data that's out there and put it someplace visible that people can check out. And so we started looking around, and what we found out was that there wasn't really any data. There wasn't really anybody paying attention. There was a handful of monitoring spots set up, and they were mostly useless because they were like way on top of buildings, and they would publish these giant wide averages rather than any kind of specific data. They were mostly set up to measure cosmic rays, and they were pretty much useless for what was going on. And we really couldn't believe that this was the case, but we were looking around, and that was it. So our big plan to just, you know, harvest this data that was out there and put it in some kind of a presentable format instantly fell apart. So the people who we were in this email chain together, my friend Joey Ito is there, this guy Peter Franken, who lives in Tokyo, is there. We have Bunny Huang, we have some guys from Tokyo Hackerspace, some guys from Hackerspace in Los Angeles, some guys who are working on some web stuff, some guys who are working on some design stuff. We had a bunch of people who were just in this email chain, and this email eventually got turned into a Skype chat room, which was sort of like a little bit less functional, crappier UI IRC. And so we were using this 24 hours a day and just having this discussion. And so we were trying to figure out how we could get data. And anytime the people in the room couldn't come up with an answer, somebody there knew someone who did. So, OK, we know a guy who builds Geiger counters. Let's pull him into this discussion. So it was a very active thread where just people kept coming in, and they would answer some questions and then jump out. And we started putting some ideas together. So we came up with plan B. And that was, we could sort of harvest the networks that we had and get the word out and raise some money and buy, you know, a couple thousand Geiger counters, give them out to people, and get these people to collect the data and publish it back. And then that way there'd be real data. So that's what we thought we would do. And so we had a Kickstarter to try to raise some money, got some things together, and then we realized that that wasn't going to work either because there were no Geiger counters. I guess before March, there was really no market for measuring radiation. Nobody cared about it. If your job was selling Geiger counters, and you sold like 5 Geiger counters a month, you were pretty psyched. Like that was big business. So instantly, the whole world supply of Geiger counters sells out like 24 hours after this meltdown, and they all like got shipped to like bomb shelters in Ohio or something. So everybody in Japan couldn't get them. We couldn't get them. And so our plan to get a whole bunch of Geiger counters and give them out to people was instantly bust right away. So we had to come up with another plan. So we got all these people that we had in this chat room. We said, let's all go to Tokyo. We'll sit down in a room. We'll put our heads together. We'll look at what we have available. And we'll try to figure out a solution. So we all got into Tokyo. We all sat down in this room. We talked to them. We said, OK, let's put everything we have on the table and try to figure out what we can do here. So we had a couple Geiger counters, and we had some duct tape. And so one of the guys who was in the room, Ray Ozzie, came up with this fantastic idea. And he said, what if we could attach a Geiger counter to a car, and if we can make this mobile? So then rather than having one device taking one reading in somebody's hand, we could go collect a whole bunch of readings with it. And maybe that would make, you know, one device a little bit more useful, and we could sort of stretch out what we had a bit more. So we're like, okay, this is a fantastic thing. So right away we put this plan together. We're gonna do a drive, and we're gonna collect this data. So this is what we did. So we took a Geiger counter, and we literally duct taped it to the window of a car. And this is brilliant. You guys will love this. Every 10 minutes, we took a picture of it with an iPhone that was geotagged. And I know, it's awesome. So we got all these pictures together, put them into iPhoto, and you know, looked at the geotags and read them by hand, and we actually had some semblance of data that we had collected over a drive. And so this was the very first thing we put together. And we were awesome. We were psyched because this actually worked. Like, we actually got something. But it sucked. That was like the worst thing possible, like trying to like look at every photo and log. It was just a nightmare. So we had to figure out another option. And so we came up with this instant iteration. Actually, I came up with instant iteration when I was making this thing. We didn't ever call it that, but I think it sounds cool. So we'll use it. But so we decided that we need to do something else. And so we came up with a system that sort of, from this point on, and I'm going to talk more about the system in a little bit, we call it BGeiGi, which is like a B in reference to a bento box, because it sort of looks like a little Japanese lunch box, basically. And so it's a Geiger counter in a kind of self-contained unit that we could stick on a car and drive around and collect some data. So the design process of how we came up with this is almost as interesting, maybe a little bit more than what we found in it. And so immediately we started taking these measurements, and literally we would design a device, go out and use it, collect some data, come back with feedback from what we were doing, how it was working, how it wasn't working, and change it, and then fix it, and build a new thing, put out, take readings with that tomorrow. So at every step of this process, we were taking readings. There was no way for us to sit around and think, well, let's get something together for 6 months from now that we're going to put it out. And you know, like we have to design something that we can take readings with tonight. And that was our motivation through this, as we kept going with it. And literally, we would come up with a design that worked and say, okay, we need to build 5 of these. And we would go to the store and buy the parts for them. And then, like, the next day, we would get ready to build them, and we would have the wrong parts because it had already changed in that 24 hours in between there. So it was really moving quickly, and we were constantly changing it. So in the first month, like, our only concern was getting something that worked. It wasn't really very usable, taking a picture, it was kind of a pain in the ass, but it actually worked and it got things done. And so by 3 months on, our concern was more, how do we make this usual? How do we make it easier to do, and how can we repeat this? And then in our longer term, you know, we wanted to figure out how not just we could do it, but how other people could do it, and how we wouldn't end up spending like $3,000 on every single one of these things. So the very first version was really big and awkward. We had a Geiger counter inside of a little watertight case and a USB GPS that we attached outside of the car. And these were running into the car to a netbook that we had that was logging the data and keeping track of it. And you know, there was a bunch of power and all sorts of obnoxiousness going on, but it worked. So we made a handful of these things. But right away, we realized that this was a problem. And then we moved on to the next version, and this is kind of the version that we've been using mostly for the past 2 years. And this is kind of called, I think we call it the Bigai Mini or something. But this is a full-size off-the-shelf Geiger counter with an Arduino and a custom shield, logs the data right in there. So everything's contained in this box. There's no cables running all over the place. GPS logs a data point every 5 seconds as we drive. Come back and we have, you know, 20,000 data points from driving around all day long, sort of Google street mapping thing, and we could start collecting this data. But you know, buying a whole bunch of commercial devices and putting everything together wasn't necessarily the most cost effective way. That cost about $1,000 for each one of those. So what we've been working on over the last year is a design for a more manufactural version. And this is about ready to go into production, and this will cuts everything in half and gets rid of like an off-the-shelf Geiger counter, just uses the actual parts that we need. So that's all coming together. And those are kind of like the big milestones as we went. But there's really, like I said, we were making changes kind of every day. So we actually had a new version that we were sort of using every 3 to 4 months. We were making versions for different things. So we had a version that was just for our volunteers who didn't necessarily know all the ins and outs of how to build a device, because a lot of, you know, we were building these in Tokyo Hackerspace. A lot of people who were building them, they were then taking them out. If something broke, they knew how to fix it. But we also had people in, you know, in neighborhoods, in different prefectures who just wanted to help out. So we were just giving them devices. So we had to build something that was a little bit more robust and that they didn't have to tinker with. They didn't have to turn switches or anything. We could just hand it to them and it would just work. So we were making different versions. We made a couple of them that was actually all the electronics stuck inside some other thing that looked like, you know, a radio or something, so that people could take them places and not attract a lot of attention if we were worried about stuff like that. So we were making lots of different versions for different things to collect all this data. What am I going to say here? To make that even easier, we started working on a kit. Everything that we've been doing is open source on this. We publish it all on a website. And we've been working on a kit that then anybody could go get the parts for. That's this. It's like tiny, right? So this does everything that we need to do. It has GPS. It has the Geiger tube in there. It takes the reading. It does everything. And so these, the parts are online. You can see the parts list. You can build this thing yourself if you want. Some of the parts are a little bit harder to find, so we're trying to get them all together, and so we can offer some kits as well. But this way, anybody anywhere can help out, start collecting this data, send it back to us, do whatever they want with it. So the reactions to this changed really quickly. So at first, like I said, those stories I told you, you know, people didn't know what was going on. They didn't necessarily want to know what's going on. They were afraid to know what was going on. Once it became clear that the situation wasn't going to go away, that it wasn't going to just get better tomorrow. And once it was clear that there really wasn't any sort of magical angel that was going to come in and take care of everything, people really started to gravitate towards us because we were the only ones out there doing anything. So we had a lot of volunteers coming in from all over the place asking how they could help, what they could do, and helping spread the word. So right away, kind of our street cred in Japan really helped push us along. And so we had volunteers who were driving things around. We had someone give us a car that became the official Safecast car, and we drive that around that's covered with all sorts of electronics. We have people strapping devices to their bikes so they can drive places that cars can't. We have universities who had crazy clearance that we couldn't get ourselves, taking these things right up to the gates of Fukushima. And so like right up to the plants, they were walking with our devices to collect this data, and we were publishing back online. So every piece of data we got, we were publishing it online immediately. And we were publishing everything with a CC0 license, so anybody could take it, anybody could use it for anything. There was no restrictions at all, and so it was spreading pretty quickly. And so when these guys took these devices all the way up to the plant inside the evacuation zones, we found something interesting, and that is, so this point here is the plant. The first circle is the mandatory evacuation zone. So everybody inside of that circle got kicked the hell out. And the second circle was the voluntary evacuation zone. So that was where they were like, well, if you want to leave, you can, but we're not going to give you any money. You know, it's up to you if you want to leave or not. And then outside of that is what was considered safe. And so what ended up happening was that there was actually a lot of people who got moved from areas with relatively low readings to areas with relatively high readings, which is a tricky situation. And so we published this data, and the very next day, the Japanese government published their data, which almost mimicked this. And it turns out that they had had it for months, and they hadn't published it, which was also problematic. So we had a lot of support. We started getting this stuff together, and we started getting this data around. We have about 300 static sensors that are all over Japan now. They're collecting readings every few minutes. They're at businesses, they're at people's houses. They're just in one place, just collecting a reading nonstop. So we know if there's anything that changes in any of these places. We also have over 100 of these mobile units that are out for volunteers. They're taking them, they're collecting them. They're attached to delivery trucks. They're all over the place. They're constantly collecting readings. And with that, we've been able to map the majority of Japan. And so we know what the levels are everywhere. And this isn't data that ever existed before that. So once we started getting this data, we had to figure out what we were going to do with it and how we could display it. And so we built these maps that could handle millions and millions of data points because there wasn't anything that could do it beforehand. And so with the maps, you can zoom all the way into a neighborhood and you can see what the reading is that was taken right outside of your house, as opposed to what was available previously, which was a giant average for your entire city. And then you get a much better picture of what's actually going on as opposed to just a couple of handful of points around. We also started taking readings all over the world, so you can see how the readings in Japan compare to everywhere else. And with this platform, we built it so you could overlay other kinds of data to it. So these big white points are where there's nuclear reactors. So you can see there's a whole bunch around us right now. Now we can actually build a giant data set for the whole world to get a snapshot of what the radiation level looks like right now. One of the things is that because we were taking really, really, really specific readings and what was available before was so vague, it's really hard to compare the two. We only kind of know, like, on average what things looked like before, and now we know exactly what they look like. So what we want to do is create this giant map, this giant data set that's a snapshot of what the world looks like right now. That this way, if something happens 10 years from now or 15 years from now, people will actually be able to look back and say, this is exactly what the radiation levels were in 2012. Now we know what's changed. Whereas what we're doing right now is guessing based on what we think global averages were. So with our visualizations, we had a very similar sort of just get things up that work, but refine it all the time process. So initially, we were only publishing the static things because we didn't think there was a future in the drives. We thought that was just kind of something we were doing just to kind of collect some data and get an idea. But it turns out the drives were actually the most important thing because the levels weren't changing. After the meltdown, that's when the contamination happened. It wasn't changing on a daily basis, so it was more important to go try to cover a lot of ground than to sit there watching one point over and over. So our approach as to what we wanted to get out to the world to check out was different. So that's when we moved over to Google Maps. So we had a different map for every single drive. And when we had a web page with, like, you know, 400 links to individual drives, that became a problem. You couldn't actually look at anything. And so then we moved to another platform where we could see everything from Japan. Then we built a new platform where we could see everything from the world. Now we just released an iOS app. Hopefully we'll have an Android version of it pretty soon as well. That's basically a virtual Geiger counter. It looks at your location, it looks at our data, tells you what readings were taken very close to you. So you can see, like, what, you know, it's not as good as having a Geiger on your hand, but it gives you something that's very accurate. We have an API, publishes out all this data, so you can query it with anything you want. You want to know just data from a certain area, just data from a certain time, just data that's over a certain reading, any of that stuff you can find. You want to find only stuff that was taken with a certain kind of device, you can do all of that. You can also send us back data that's tagged with all the same sort of stuff so that you can continue to add to it. And so a lot of people are taking this data and using it now. Yahoo Japan has our data on the front page of their site where they're showing off their radiation. And just a few months ago, the government of Fukushima actually published their own maps of the world radiation data, sort of as like their sort of efforts to help the world with this, and they're using all Safecast data for their maps, which was pretty exciting for us that the government of Fukushima is backing up all of their claims with our work. So in the first 6 months, we had 1 million data points. Just the other day, we broke 5 million. So it's moving right along. And so you might ask about the official data. What's coming out? If you were paying attention at the time of all this went down, you might remember that there was this big sort of hullabaloo with TEPCO giving out data, and then the Japanese government kind of coming in and like slapping them and saying, "You guys aren't doing this well enough. We're going to take over." You know, that TEPCO was kind of saying, "Well, here's this data, but we lost the data for these hours, and we only have data for this neighborhood, but not that neighborhood. Oops." And so the Japanese government was like, "You know, you can't do this anymore. We're going to take over because we have to give people data." And so the Japanese government has been publishing the data since then, and they have just updated their data set to now have about 30,000 data points. And it is provided in a handy PDF. And it's copywritten left and right, so if you want to use it for anything other than looking at, you have to write a request. And then they'll think about whether they'll let you use it. And basically what's happened with that is people have just stopped asking them, because they've become irrelevant in this whole situation. Nobody trusts the official data anymore. Nobody cares about it. It pales in comparison to what's been collected by the volunteers and the people in the areas. So they sort of wrote themselves out of the equation in general. This is all happening because from the very first minute of this, we were talking about it online. We were publishing our plans. We were talking about the devices we were building. We were talking about what worked, what didn't work. And so by having everybody involved from the very beginning and reaching out to as many people as possible to help us, we built up this really fantastic trust with lots of communities and lots of people who were able to jump in and help with our projects and tweak things. And we had some of the world's experts in this stuff just like diving in and throwing a whole bunch of information at us that we were able to use and move really quick on. And we thought that it was kind of cool, and we thought that this was pretty interesting. And it became really clear a few months ago. There was this, they called it a conference, but it was really sort of like a trade show in Japan called RadiX. And it was for all of these businesses who are in the business of like measuring radiation now or cleaning up contamination. There was lots of people showing off these giant trash bags that you could put dirt in, because that's how they clean up radiation. And so we were like, okay, well, we're going to go to this thing and we're going to show off what we've done. Maybe there's some people there who could use it. Maybe we can get some good information back. You know, this is a market that we haven't really, you know, we haven't reached out to any companies. We've been talking to people. So, you know, maybe this would be some cool back and forth here. And this was one of the big highlights of the show. So this is like a giant trailer. It's like, it's big. And it attaches to a car, and it has GPS and a radiation monitor. So you can drive it around, and it'll take a reading of of the radiation where you're driving. And, you know, so we went there, and we were like, hey, you know, like, hey guys, we got this thing, you know? And they were like, what do you mean? Like, how did you do this? And they were really sort of disappointed to find out that most of the people who they were expecting to be their customers and who they were hoping would pay like $500,000 to buy these things from there had been volunteering for Safecast for over a year and had collected millions of data points already. So that was kind of cool. But that's what happens when you know, sort of sit in your office with your head down doing your thing and don't talk to anybody and think that you're the only one who's working on anything. And like I said, the community aspect was really the most important piece of this because we were constantly reaching out to people. We were constantly, you know, we would take measurements and people would come up and say, like, what are you doing? And we would say, like, hey, here, look, here's the website, here's the data, here's a device, like, go to your house and like, take a bunch of measurements and then, like, send us so we know what's going on. So right away, people were very excited because prior to that, there was people showing up with, like, with hazmat suits and, like, taking some readings and then, like, leaving. And so then there's, like, you know, people in their front yard, like, playing with their kids going, like, what the fuck was that? And so getting the people involved and getting the neighborhoods and getting, you know, the local communities really, like, powered this whole thing. So, like, it wasn't just that, like, we made a couple devices. It was really that this entire network of people, you know, sort of pulled together and made such a huge difference. And then we started doing, you know, seminars. We go to schools now. We give talks all over the place where we're constantly passing out information so people can get this data. And it's really sort of changed the whole perception of you know, what people are expecting from authorities in this sort of incident. I don't think if something happens again in Japan, that any of the folks who have been involved with this anyway are going to sort of look to a government or something as the source of information. They're going to turn to each other and they're going to think, like, we can solve this. We don't have to sit around and wait for someone else to come and solve it. And I think that's a pretty important shift in how this is perceived. And part of this was that we knew we were going to make a bunch of mistakes, so we just wanted to make them as fast as we possibly could, and as much in public as we possibly could, so someone could possibly point out, like, hey, you're doing this wrong, and here's the fix for it and everything. So we made as many mistakes as quick as possible. We're still making mistakes, but moving really fast, and that made a big difference with it. So now we're actually looking at if there's other things that could benefit from what we figured out in the past 2 years looking at radiation. Are there other environmental things that are also sort of vaguely reported and could be helped by having a whole bunch of people taking really specific readings? And we decided that air quality fits into this as well. So now we're working on building some air quality devices that would do the same sort of thing. People could put them at their house and they could take readings. You could see how the levels change during the day if you live near a big road, if the air gets worse when there's traffic, or maybe you live near a factory that, like, spits out a bunch of crap certain times a day. I don't know, maybe it doesn't, but if we build a bunch of these devices and we can use the same platforms that we put together for radiation, that might make a difference. And we might be able to do something cool with that. So that's kind of what we're working on. That is the end of my talk because I thought it was a 20-minute talk, not an hour talk. But that way there's lots of time for questions, if anybody has any questions.
So if you have questions, there are mics in the aisles. Number one, go ahead.
Yeah, hi, hello. Thanks for being here and sharing that with us. That was good to hear. Maybe you want to say a few words about your Kickstarter campaign. I backed you there. I thought that was a very good idea of getting the money for the Geiger counters mm-hmm. that you put in the field, mm-hmm. how that worked with the Kickstarter guys and
sure. So we've actually done two Kickstarter campaigns. So the first one we did, which was what I mentioned in there, was that we wanted to buy a bunch of devices and give them out to people, and then we weren't able to do that because they didn't exist, right? And so what we did was we bought all the pieces and built the devices. You know, we went, we talked to the manufacturers, and we said, just give us all the parts you have for the half-constructed ones, and that's what we built most of those B-Geigies with, was with all these parts from Geiger counters. And then rather than giving them to people, we loan them to somebody who drives around and collects a whole bunch of data and then gives it back. So that's really what funded the entire first year and how we were able to collect, you know, the first 2 or 3 million data points was with the first Kickstarter campaign. So that was fantastic. Then we had a second Kickstarter campaign this year because we realized that since nobody had been paying attention to Geiger counters or all this stuff, there really hadn't been any development work done on them since like 1980. You know, the devices that we were using, that we were buying, that was when they were designed, and they hadn't been updated since then. So we thought that we could we had a bunch of smart people working on this project, and we had a lot of momentum, so we thought we might be able to help with that. And so we designed a new Geiger counter that was basically an update to those old versions, and we completely open sourced the design on that. And so this company who had been has been very helpful to us all along, International Medcom, they said they want to make this device. And so we asked them if to sort of give back to the Kickstarter community who had been so helpful and with us first part, if they could do a limited edition version that we could offer on Kickstarter, and then that would be it would be a special thing just for like sort of people who were in touch with us, they could get this cool version of it, and they said yes. And so that's the one we did earlier this year. And we were hoping that they would be out before the end of the year. It looks like they're gonna ship in January. I have one, I have a prototype one. If you wanna see it, I'll show it to you afterwards. It's small, so if I show it here, you won't be able to see it. But that's like a much, much, much smaller sort of like iPhone-y size Geiger counter that anybody can use and collect really great data. And it interfaces with the apps and the website and all of that stuff. And so Kickstarter has been an amazingly helpful tool for us to reach out to lots of people, their communities that we didn't necessarily have access to, and also just like a ton of people coming out of the woodwork, just like, you know, here's $5, here's $10, like that. It was really amazing to see how many people just wanted to help. And you know, like in the first beginning of this, we just bought stuff ourselves, you know, because we didn't know what was going to go on, we didn't know how it was going to work, and we're just like, well, like, we got to do something. And so we're just like running to the store and buying stuff. And so when, you know, when that money came in from Kickstarter, it kind of changed everything, and we were able to move much quicker.
Number two.
Hi. Over here. Okay. Right. First, I want to say that it's really, really awesome you did this, because after the Fukushima disaster, the TEPCO and the Japanese government totally dropped the ball on this. Mm-hmm. So it's really cool you did this. But how did you handle things like meter calibration, measurement procedures, different Geiger tubes having different response curves, and things like that? Because radiation measurement can get really complicated very quickly.
Yeah, so what we did was we talked to experts, and we brought in people who had been building Geiger counters for 30 years, that was like their job, their business, they ran companies, people who built sensor networks before. The best experts that we could possibly get our hands on, we reached out to them, had them come in. We standardized around one specific sensor. So every reading we have has been taken with one specific sensor. We have a set height that we take all of the readings at. So we standardized what we were doing on every level. When we reach out to volunteers, we train people for over an hour before we give them a device so they know exactly what to do. And then we did several readings in the same places over and over and over again so that if there's anything weird, we can spot it. We take them with different devices. All of the data that we have is trackable all the way back to the individual device. So if something weird pops up on a specific device, we can track that. So that's part of the thing, is that we didn't want to create a data set that would be useless. We didn't want to go through all this work and then have somebody go, oh, well, that's interesting, now I have to go remeasure it myself so that I could actually use it. We wanted to create a data set that would actually be usable. And so that's why we had the pretty much everybody that we could. We partnered with Keio University and Kyoto University and all of these like experts who were knew what they were talking about and could come and tell us what to do, and then we would pass on that information to people.
Okay, the internet. Very cool. Six questions.
Hello. First of all, your blog.safecast.org site got DDoS, community DDoS. So a lot of people are interested in your website.
Oh, okay.
Here.
Yeah. Oh, okay. There you go. Yes.
Now the question. How were the Geiger counters calibrated, and what was the response to gamma rays at typical energy levels?
So they're calibrated by the manufacturer. So that's like we were working with a company that builds Geiger counters specifically. So they were calibrated specifically looking for cesium, which is the major contaminant that was coming out from Fukushima. And so the devices that we have measure alpha, beta, and gamma. So we're collecting a CPM, like a full total radiation count. We're not filtering out and only looking for certain things. We're looking for the entire radiation and then filtering after the fact with natural background. But we relied on the actual Geiger counter manufacturers for that piece of it. We were worried about the data after the fact.
And how accurate are the devices in comparison to the one from the trade fair?
Better. our devices are much better.
Who was paying for your flights?
We paid for everything ourselves. And then once we started getting, we got some grant funding. Knight Foundation has been very supportive of us. There's a group called Global Giving who has been very supportive of us. There's been a couple companies from Japan who have just said, here's a check. Just do what you need to do. We don't want to be named or whatever, but just you're doing good stuff, so please keep doing it. So we set up a nonprofit, and we're a nonprofit organization. But those funds pay for hardware and travel, basically.
And was there anything measured at the coast of Alaska or America yet?
We haven't been in Alaska, but we've measured all across the U.S. We haven't detected anything from Fukushima in that. Even in Hawaii, we haven't seen stuff. But we're taking measurements every place we possibly can.
Okay. And what kind of radiation is measured? Alpha, beta, or gamma, or
all of it? Yeah, we take total okay. count, alpha, beta, and gamma. So we measure in CPM.
And how high is the radiation dose you accumulated?
I'm sorry?
How high is the radiation dose you accumulated?
Me, personally?
Yeah, you.
I don't know. It's probably a lot. But, you know, I fly, so it's nothing, right? Like, you know, I spend 2 weeks in Japan, like, going to the gates of Fukushima, and that's, you know, about as much as exposure as flying to Japan in the first place. So.
Okay, number three.
Okay, since I've been there too, so I've accumulated some too. I've not a question on the technology, mm-hmm. just did you have any problems with officials, the media, or the locals?
Okay, so officials, no. From a national level, we were ignored. The national Japanese government never mentioned us in any way. They never talked about us. We reached out to them. We never heard back, so they just completely ignored us. Local government has become some of our biggest allies in the world because they were also getting no information back from the national government. So like I said, you know, like our data is driving the official maps from Fukushima Prefecture. So we have all these local politicians who are our volunteers. We have like mayors of you know, towns and things with Safecast devices on their car who like send us data every day. So local politician support has been great. Media support has been great. And then, like I mentioned in the thing, like initially locals didn't know what to think of the entire situation, so they were very wary of everything. And then when it became clear that they could trust us and that we were trying to do cool things as opposed to you know, the other data, which was sort of just telling them to stop worrying about it and go away, then they became all of our volunteers.
So we don't have too much time left, so please stay focused. Number four.
I study radiochemistry in mm-hmm. University of Helsinki in Finland. Another guest stole my question, but I'm going to ask. The structure of Geiger counter is so that if you take gamma counts, it's quite different from the beta that's usually with the, well, what's associated with the Fukushima decay. Mm-hmm. Were you focused on that? And second quickie, will you help me make a dissertation out of this?
Yes, I mean, like I said, we had teams and teams of people who at all of the universities in Japan who this is the stuff they work on. We had the people who build sensor networks to monitor radiation around Chernobyl, around Three Mile Island. Like the people who that's what they have done for their entire lives advised us on what to be measuring and how to look for it and what data to collect that would be most useful to people later on. And then absolutely, I mean, everything that we've done is completely open and out in the public. You can grab anything that we have. You know, you can email us online. We'll give you any more information that you want.
Thanks for trusting all those people, although I have to admit that not my department knew anything about your project.
Oh. Okay.
Number two.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to mention a device that can measure radiation, and that's cheaper. You can compare it, of course, with your device, but it's your mobile phone, mm-hmm. and you just need a $3 software on it. And you can take a rough measurement. It's not as precise as a Geiger counter or spectrometer or something, but it's $3 and it's called radioactivity counter. It's on the app market and it's also available for iOS.
Yeah,
I'm not the author.
That's for entertainment purposes only. Like you're not gonna.
It really works.
It works, but it's not reliable in any way. I mean,
you can watch a video on YouTube. They compare it with a Geiger counter.
If it's on YouTube,
it's the same rating.
Hey, I got nothing. If it's on YouTube,
I have it here. You can look at it.
Okay, number one.
I very much liked this kind of assessment, both technology-wise and also deployment-wise. These days when at least one nation is reserving the so-called Samson option, this kind of measuring network is extremely important. Another remark about the history, I was a little bit disappointed you mentioned that we didn't know and it was a news and I understood within 24 hours because I know what's Chernobyl and already 12 years I have two measuring devices, one at my home and another at my working place. So it's extremely important that it's not RFID. Anybody make gadgets and it's like social issue RFID. This is the actual social issue. So I very much recommend to have such kind of device. How many HDs you have, hard disks at your home? Buy one device and keep it really.
Thanks.
Okay, the internet.
Do you know about Parisian blue?
No.
It's some kind of medicine?
Nope.
Okay, number three.
About the air quality project, what data do you think to collect and when will it be available on the market and what is your vision about the air pollution sensoring?
So we're just starting on that right now. So we only have a couple prototypes that all sort of work differently. We haven't started collecting any real data with it yet. We're having a hackathon in Tokyo in the middle of January. The data is on our website. We'll be doing it live online, working on and the air quality devices are part of what we're going to be working on with that. So right now we're just trying to figure out. Excuse me. What exactly we need to be measuring, because we don't want to build a bunch of devices that measure the wrong stuff. So we're talking to people and playing with prototypes to see what we can do and then what's replicatable. As far as what we think will happen, we don't know. I mean, it just, in looking around, that seemed to be something that suffered from a lot of the same problems that we saw with radiation, in that it was being reported in these really, really giant averages, but when you actually took a reading, it could change very quickly in specific areas. And so we thought that since we already built this platform for radiation, if we could add just another device to it and do the same sort of thing, that might be useful. So we're really just sort of diving into it right now.
Okay, number four.
Did you also attach Geiger counters to ship and measure the coastline?
yes, we've been out in the water and it drops to zero instantly. So there's no residual radiation above the water. Measuring water is a whole giant problem in itself because water actually shields the particles. So we haven't gotten into that. We haven't gotten into measuring water or food or whatever, but we've been out in boats and there's, you know, whatever the normal background is, it drops to zero the second you're on the water. So.
Okay, number one.
First of all, thanks for the nice talk and the information you gave about, but I've got some questions about the data integrity mm-hmm. and the data quantity and the education. So what to tell the people what to do actually with this data they read on their monitors. Yeah. So first of all, you said that you train the people 1 hour for using the device actually, but are they trained also that contamination on the device affects it, or that they measure in 1 meter distance from ground, etc.?
We show them how to attach it to their car at the specific height.
Not just to push the power button. I mean, just but there are certain strategies how to measure nuclear radiation or generally.
We really had like the world's experts of measuring contaminated area advising us and working with us every step of the way to make sure that what we were collecting was useful. Because we didn't want to spend any time doing this. If then someone who knew more than us would come in and say, well, you did this wrong, so it's useless. I mean, it would be a waste of our time.
And what about the quantity? I mean, I've been doing measurements in Tokyo the 3 weeks after the incident, and actually we measured some hot spots, yeah, but it was just one spot. So do you actually make sure that you don't just have one measurement, but you have good statistics in your measurements?
Yeah, you can.
Because you publish such pretty pictures of your radiation levels, yeah, but actually I can never say uncertainties or something.
No,
or
you can see all of it. You can zoom all the way in and pick an individual point. You can download the entire data set.
So you make sure that you don't have just one measurement for one data point or something for, one area.
Some of the points, like in Tokyo, like near us, there's points that have been measured like, you know, 30 or 40,000 times. Like, I mean, there's a lot of repeated measurements.
So it's good statistics, actually?
Yeah.
Okay. And the most important question probably is, do you educate the people what to do with these values, actually? Because if I throw a number on you, you probably don't know what to do with it. So
we specifically don't, because there's no agreement in sort of the health physics world about what's safe or what's not safe. There's a huge argument.
This is not true. I'm sorry.
Well,
Linear threshold is not an argument. Yeah, we do not argue.
I understand that there's a lot of people who don't feel that way. But the minute anybody classifies a reading as safe or unsafe, there's a huge group of people who will come out and say that that's bogus. So we have been very clear to not take any sides on whether anything is safe or not safe.
Okay,
we publish the data, and then people can take it and interpret it on their own.
Okay. Can we talk afterwards, maybe?
Sure.
Thank you.
Okay, number four.
Hi. First of all, thank you very much for this very efficient and fast approach to the problem. As far as I understood, you're still using the quite accurate but maybe expensive sensor. Did you check for cheaper sensors that are available to measure radiation?
Yeah, we checked for as much as we possibly could, and the cheaper sensors don't take as detailed radiation, or they take much longer to take a reading that's accurate. There's a lot of cheaper sensors that you have to keep it in one place for 10 or 15 minutes to get an accurate measurement, and that's not going to work if we're sticking on in a car and driving. We need something that can get an accurate reading in a second.
All right.
So then we can use that.
So how much is the sensor you're actually using at the moment?
Just the sensor is, just that one piece is $125.
Thank you.
Okay, two questions from the internet.
Where can we get these Geiger counters?
You can get Geiger counters that we've been using from International Medcom. If you go to medcom.com, they sell them. And they're the ones who are producing the new one that we designed. It's not available yet. And if you go to our website, we have a link to our GitHub where we publish all of the software that we use for this stuff. We publish parts lists to help build stuff. And then, like I said, we're going to have a kit with the parts available hopefully soon for people who don't want to go buy the individual parts themselves.
And is there anything to do left?
There's a ton. If you look at the map, there's much more of the world that's not been measured than what has been measured. So we're looking for people in places that we haven't been yet to help out. Like, we definitely need a lot of that.
Okay, time is up. At 10:45, we will take Jean down to floor zero at the CCC Freiburg if you have any questions. So, but from now on, thank you, Jean.
All right.